You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Yes, it does, Scott, and thanks, and welcome to The Exchange, everybody. I am Brian Sullivan. A big show. Here's what's ahead. Wall Street may have liked the trade deal, but many small businesses across America aren't sold. Why? Because the tariffs are still here. We'll look at the other side of the trade deal. Plus, another day, another all-time high. Are investors treating companies on fundamentals? Or could this just be a Fed-fueled rally? We'll discuss and debate. And Signet shines, a luxury overload. And are we in for a remodeling slowdown? All that ahead when we begin, again, with today's markets, Seema Modi, and yet, Seema, another record high.
It's just the type of market environment we're living in, Brian. 3 hours left in trade. Take a look at global markets here, because a muted response overseas to the signing of that phase one trade deal. Fractional gains in Europe, Shanghai Composite ending lower. But as Brian was saying, fresh record highs here in the U.S. The S&P 500 now above 3,300. All 11 sectors are higher on the day. But we want to draw your attention to utilities at a new high, led by a number of power generation companies that offer dividends. So this still seems to be a rate play at the moment. Lastly, take a look at Morgan Stanley. When was the last time you saw a bank up 8% on the day, on pace for its best day since 2012? That's what we're seeing with Morgan Stanley, delivering an impressive beat on revenue and earnings and raising its financial targets. This, of course, capping off a mixed week for bank earnings. Brian, back to you.
All right, Seema, thank you very much. Well, there were certainly many companies that cheered the signing of the trade deal with China yesterday. But one group that maybe wasn't so enthusiastic are the small and mid-sized domestic companies around America. Over the past year, this show, The Exchange, has talked to lots of small businesses and their owners who shared the impact that tariffs had on them. Here's what some of them told us after the deal. Lin Lee, CEO of Society9, says, quote, "This deal has yet confirmed a reduction in existing tariffs, so it still leaves a lot of businesses holding their breath." Dan DeGree, CEO of speakers company Misco, says, "The agreement leaves us in the same place we were before. With continued uncertainty and the majority of the tariffs still in place, it's a disappointing outcome." And Arnold Kamler, CEO of Kent International, the bicycle company, says, "While we are pleased that the phase one deal represents a step in the right direction, there are many questions not answered here as answered." Joining us more with reaction from the business community across the country is Neil Bradley, Executive Vice President of the United States Chamber of Commerce. I'm sure, Neil, that your phone, your email, your pager, whatever you got, was blowing up yesterday with all your constituent companies calling you. What are they saying about the signing of the deal?
Well, thanks for having me, Brian. Our phones have been blowing up, our emails as well. Listen, I think most of our members, and we're proud to represent millions of small businesses across the country, they recognize this for what it is, phase one, and what has to be a multi-phase deal. The good news is that the threat of additional tariffs are off. Some of the current tariffs have been reduced in terms of the amount that's being collected, but we still have tariffs in place on a large variety of goods that we import. The most important thing is phase one moving to phase two. And in phase two, we can really tackle the key fundamental problems that are driving this trade dispute. The intellectual property theft in China, the forced localization, the state subsidies that create an unfair advantage for Chinese companies over American companies. And if we can resolve those, we can remove the tariffs that have been put in place.
Well, that's
the ultimate
key.
Goal, and we took a step forward towards that, but we got a lot of work to do.
Well, listen, I'm sure that I could poll 500 companies, and they would say, we want the tariffs gone. Your offices are pretty much right around the corner from the White House. We've got the Capitol building over your shoulder. You're dialed in, Neil. Any indication of when these tariffs might get killed?
Well, when we can come to an agreement, right? And so our job at the U.S. Chamber is to push to get that agreement sooner rather than later. That's why we look at phase one as a step towards getting there. The second the signatures were inked on phase one, we began working on how can we get to phase two. We're encouraging the administration to engage with China immediately. We're encouraging the Chinese to live up to the commitments that they made yesterday. And the more we can work on this, the more we can resolve some of these issues, the quicker the tariffs can go away. And that's ultimately our goal. Our goal on behalf of our business members, our small business members, is to get rid of these tariffs and solve the fundamental problems that drove this dispute in the first place.
But do we, listen, you guys, I know you, and you have been sort of pounded on the president and his administration, and I'm sure everybody in that, our former colleague Larry, are they telling you that it's likely to happen sooner than later? Are we getting any word that this is something that maybe even, Neil, is on the table?
Well, listen, I think that the administration understands what a priority it is. They understand the implications for the economy. You know, listen, the economy is incredibly important. We're going into an election year. Everyone wants to see this economy growing, reaching a 12th record year of economic expansion. That's not going to happen if we have enlarged trade disputes. So everyone shares the interest in getting this resolved. That's what we hear out of the administration. But it's going to be tough, and we should be realistic about the challenges that we face ahead. You know, it's worth noting that today the Senate passed USMCA. It took us a long time to get to that point, too, longer than we wanted at the U.S. chamber, but we got it done, and we restored certainty for 12 million Americans who rely on a trade between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico for their jobs, including 120,000 small businesses. We can get this China deal done, too. We just have to keep our shoulder to the grindstone.
Yep. All right, Neil Bradley of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. We appreciate it. An important topic for hundreds of thousands of companies across America. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's stay on this and dive a little deeper into one of the areas that has been impacted big time by the tariffs, and that is retail and the companies that supply retailers. Steve Lamar is president and CEO of the American Apparel and Footwear Association. Perhaps, Steve, no group more affected than this, with the exception maybe of some steel and aluminum companies. What are your companies saying about the signing of the trade deal? The same thing. We're glad it got done. We're glad it's not getting worse, but we need these tariffs gone.
Well, we're certainly glad it's not getting worse, but if you look at it, it's 96 pages of a trade deal, and you don't see the words tariff elimination in there anywhere at all. I mean, the reality is all the goods that were being tariffed the day before the deal was announced are going to be tariffed on February 14th, which is the first day the deal takes effect. This is 92% of apparel, 53% of footwear, 68% of home textiles, all bags, hats, and gloves, all these products coming from China, they're all still facing tariffs. And these are high tariffs. This isn't monopoly money. This is stuff that we really have to pay the U.S. government.
And when we look across the spectrum, we've got this USMCA signed as well. I mean, or at least in the Senate passed. And it's interesting because at the same time on this trade fight, we get sort of backed off on it a little bit. We've got this deal now in place with Mexico and Canada. Does that reduce the sting at all, kind of the aloe vera on the wound of the tariffs? Does the USMCA help one bit?
Well, we're thrilled that the USMCA was passed by the Senate today, and we've been encouraging the administration to implement it as soon as possible. And it does give us a good shot at predictability. We've got a couple of 100,000 jobs in the textile and apparel and footwear industry, billions of dollars worth of trade, provides us a lot more predictability, and we're really pleased to see that moving forward. But that doesn't remove the costs that we encounter when we do business with China. Those are real dollars, and that results in price increases for American consumers. It results in companies not being able to invest in manufacturing, invest in innovation. When they've got to pay those tariffs, those taxes to the U.S. government, they can't use those resources to grow their own businesses or to pass the savings on to their consumers.
How are they doing otherwise with the economy?
They're doing great. You know, we're seeing the stock market at record highs, and we love to see that. You know, the tariff mitigation is the name of the game. People are being very creative to try and avoid these tariffs. It is a cost, and it's a cost that we, you know, don't want to have to pay.
Do you think that the signing of the phase one part of the deal, if you've got a company, a member company, Steve, that was thinking about taking their supply chain out of China to Bangladesh or Vietnam or Mexico or the United States, do you think they reverse those plans now, or should they go ahead and try to diversify that supply chain because you never know where this is going to end up?
Yeah, we keep telling our members it's time to continue to diversify. That's what our members are telling us. You know, perhaps people were over-concentrated in China, but companies are looking at other sourcing venues really around the world, realizing that, you know, they don't want to move out of China where they've got good quality, good skills, good capabilities, good efficiencies. But if there's a lot of uncertainty about China, and remember, the phase one deal, not only does it keep tariffs in place, but it uses tariffs as an enforcement tool. And, you know, like anyone else, we want to hold China accountable. We don't think taxing our own citizens is the best way to do that.
Steve Lamar with the American Apparel and Footwear Association. Steve, we appreciate your views on this as well. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
All right, we're just getting started. Don't go anywhere. Here's what else is coming up on The Exchange.
Coming up, the markets continue to hit new highs almost daily. But what's really driving these gains? Are we actually in a Fed-induced rally? Plus, is Tesla's run about to hit a speed bump? And home remodeling spending is expected to slow this year. A look at why and the names it could hit. This is The Exchange on CNBC.
All right, welcome back to The Exchange. All you investors out there, you're probably opening up your 401ks, your 529s, whatever it is, and probably smiling because stocks continue to hit new record highs. But should you be thanking the Federal Reserve? Allow us to explain a bit. Check out this chart. Since September, the S&P 500 and the Fed's balance sheet have basically moved higher in lockstep. You recall, that's about when the Fed, about 3 or 4 months ago, began lowering rates while also putting billions of dollars new into the financial markets, in part through its operations in the repo market. So you're looking at this chart and you go, which is which? It doesn't matter. The point is they're tied together, it looks like. So the question is this. The rally's good. We're all making money. But is it because only of the Fed or fundamentals still at play? Joining us now is Andre Garcia Amaya, founder and CEO of Zoe Financial, and John Spallanzani of Miller Value Partners. When I mentioned this chart, John, you rolled your eyes. You wanted to throw something at me. How much of this market run is the Fed? 100%? 0%?
It's never just one thing, right? I mean, like I said in the break, I can make a chart, two things, compare two things, and make it look bullish or bearish just by changing the time frame, changing the number of days, whatever. So I think
that is not what we did there, by the way. I mean, that's a 3 or 4 month chart of the balance sheet expansion.
Obviously, the Fed injected liquidity because they were afraid of a repo hiccup around the turn of the year. Whether all that money that they were putting into the repo market went into stocks, I doubt that very highly. But we've had a sea change in the Fed's attitude that you see Bloomberg quotes every day saying, we're going to let inflation run above 2%. Mm-hmm. Now, that is a huge change from prior Feds, right, and prior monetary policy where 2% was always seen as a ceiling. So that's actually forward guidance that's just starting to get into the market, right? People really don't believe. They're saying, well, they're thinking that, well, the Fed's going to let, will they really let it go through 2%? It's not even close to 2% now. But now they're saying, we're not only are we not going to stop at 2%, we're going to let it go through. So that means no rate hikes, really, until we get above 2%. I mean, if you take them literally, what they say.
Well, you know, somebody said, Andre, like, why does this repo market stuff matter for the equity markets? And I'm going to give you the worst sort of analogy, but it's the best one that I could come up with. I was talking to somebody about it this morning. I said, you're going out to dinner with a friend. You take $100 that you think you're going to buy. Your friend buys. All of a sudden, you've got $100 of money that you did not spend. You can spend it on something else. And these actions in the repo market are in some ways freeing up cash for the big players on Wall Street. The Fed bought lunch.
That could be the case. I mean, you could take that $100 and save it as well, right? So that's where the animal spirits have to be around, and there has to be that momentum for people to say, actually, I kind of want to spend it because my neighbor also spent their money and they have now a new Tesla, right? So that's where the animal spirits have to still be around. And from that perspective, I think that's really part of the equation, right? The fact that we had such a strong year last year and the fact that we're not seeing that recession that everyone's talking about, the more people think, maybe, you know what, this could go on for a much longer period. The one other thing that I would add that I think the market's trying to smell about this year is that the global economy could actually see some reacceleration in that first quarter versus last year, especially in the second half of last year. It was actually decelerating. Right, so that's, I think, part of the equation that the markets is trying to predict.
Because 90 central bank cuts. There is some fundamentals at play.
One more thing that you have to look at when you're looking at your beautiful chart is that the flows do not correlate well with your chart, right? So basically you're saying if you look at equity flows, the flows are going into bonds and money markets. They're not going into equities. Equity flows are actually down year on year.
I thought BlackRock just got $75 billion into their
Someone's ETFs. Equity flows are net negative, okay? They're down.
Really? Overall?
Yes. Yeah, I'll send you the chart. Yeah, overall.
We love charts. Yes. Send us your chart. I'll send you a chart back. Yeah. I will see your chart.
So therefore, the correlation that you're making is not really working right now. But as you said, right, emerging markets are picking up. You have the BRICS reducing rates. We have global MMT, right, modern monetary theory taking hold where everybody is deficit spending. Even our own budget deficit is off the charts. But nobody's talking about that now because why? Because everybody's still thinking about 2008 and the Great Recession and the financial crisis. And they will do anything, including our own Fed, to get inflation over 2% because right now we are very close to the lower bound and we cannot cut rates.
Well, okay, my friend.
Yes, sir.
In the battle of the charts, I don't need a chart to know this. And you sort of mumbled it there, and I think it's an important point. You said someone's buying. Stocks go up for one reason. There's more buying pressure than selling pressure. So somebody is buying.
We are in the we are in the land of large numbers, too. So at 1,500, right, we had S&P move 10% is a lot different.
I know. We did the math. I know. Listen, right? we did it. So 20 to 25,000 on the Dow is a 25% move. 25 to 30 is a 20% move. Yep. It gets smaller. But somebody, who's doing the buying, you think, right here?
Well, I think.
Mom and pop? Hedge funds?
I mean, as I said, I don't know exactly who's buying, but there's been enough buying that the market's at all-time highs, right? The one thing to look at is earnings as well, right? And we just came out of actually an earnings recession in the last quarter. I think that the market at some point, if the earnings don't deliver, that will be kind of a check on this animal spirits. But we haven't seen it, right? I mean, the fact that we had negative earnings growth and the market's at all-time highs is telling us that the investor is okay with some pain last year as long as we see those earnings this year. So that will be a big litmus test.
And we're also in TINA. We're still in TINA, right? There is no alternative. Right? Where else are you going to put your money? In bonds? In credit?
Equity markets have done great. Yes. So it's a good discussion. It was a good discussion. We're going to get you back on with all your charts. Fancy charts.
Yeah, some nice charts coming from
Dancing
Miller Value.
With the charts.
It's our 20th anniversary. We have 20 years of charts at Miller Value.
It's fantastic. John, thank you very much. Andre, thank you very much. Good discussion there. All right, on deck. This stock soaring on strong holiday sales, up 40% today. The name and whether it will continue to shine, that's a hint. Plus, despite those record highs for stocks that we just talked about, something surprising is happening in housing. The story and the moves behind it. And don't forget, you can always catch CNBC Live while you're on the go on the CNBC app. Download it if you have not already. We are back in 2 minutes. Welcome back. We've got some breaking news related to the baseball sign-stealing scandal. Eric Chemie has that breaking news for you right now. Eric, what do you got?
That's right, Brian. So the Mets, according to reports, they are now out in terms of Carlos Beltran being their manager. Carlos Beltran is out as the Mets manager. Remember, he was a player on that Houston Astros team in 2017. He was the only player named in those reports. This is now the third manager who's lost his job as a result of this. Houston's manager and GM, of course, were fired. And then Boston Red Sox, Alex Cora, he is no longer there. He was a bench coach on that Astros team. And now Carlos Beltran, he had just been hired as the Mets manager. He hadn't actually managed a game yet. So he had going to be hired and fired before ever actually managing a game for the Mets because of his actions as a player in 2017 with the Astros. Brian,
and you have just over a month now until pitchers and catchers. I mean, right. You're basically losing a manager with a month to go and trying to figure out now who will run the team. What about the rest? And I don't want to put you on the spot too much, Eric. What about the rest of the Mets front office? Their GM, I think, is only beginning his second year now.
Well, remember, we've got that storyline coming through where Stevie Cohen is eventually going to take over as the majority owner of the Mets from the Wilpon. So you've got, from ownership, a transition situation there. So it depends on who's really got the power right now. Is it the Wilpons? Is it Cohen? Who's calling those shots? Of course, we reached out to the Mets just a few minutes ago. They had no comment about any of this.
So the ownership is not in flux, but certainly there are multiple parties who may have multiple points of view. You now have no manager for the Mets a month before spring training. Things are not looking up in Queens, Eric.
They were never looking up in Queens, Brian. This is the story of the Mets, right?
Yeah. Eric, you said it. Eric Chemie, thank you very much. Appreciate that. Carlos Beltran out before ever coaching one game with the New York Mets. Airlines, trucks, and custodial banks are your top stock stories right now. Here are some of the movers at this hour. Shares of Spirit Airlines up about 8%. This on updated fourth quarter guidance that showed revenue per available seat mile declined less than some expected. Shares of warehouse and delivery services company XPO Logistics soaring up 11%. The CEO, Brad Jacobs, telling Mad Money's Jim Cramer it is exploring a sale of the company or a spinoff or more of some of its businesses. And Bank of New York Mellon, the worst performer in the S&P 500 right now. That is, the company reports revenue in the last quarter that fell short of expectations. Core expenses at BNY Mellon were higher than expected. All right, let's get a CNBC News update right now. For that, we go to Sue Herrera. Sue.
Thank you so much, Brian. Here's what's happening at this hour, everyone. Seven House Democrats, led by Adam Schiff, making the solemn walk across the Capitol for a second day to open the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. Earlier, Senate Majority Leader McConnell criticized House Speaker Pelosi, while Senate Minority Leader Schumer, again, argues for witnesses.
Well, nothing says seriousness and sobriety like handing out souvenirs, as though this were a happy bill signing instead of the gravest process in our Constitution.
A trial without witnesses is not a trial. A trial without documents is not a trial. That is why every completed impeachment trial in our nation's history, every single one that has gone to completion, 15, have included witnesses.
Diplomats from countries that lost citizens in last week's air disaster in Iran honoring those victims today in London. They lit a candle to commemorate the victims. Iran's military admitted to downing the plane, killing all 176 people on board. You are up to date. That's the news update this hour. Brian, back to you.
All right, Sue Herrera, thank you very much. All right, here's what else is coming up on The Exchange.
Ahead, Signet shares shine. California is causing Tesla problems. Pizza is king in delivery. And the new financial crime that's hitting banks. It's all coming up on The Exchange.
Troubling signs for Tesla, a diamond in the rough, and pizza's slice of the delivery pie just keeps getting bigger. Just a few of the topics in today's rapid fire. Here now to break down the stories and the headlines, Robert Frank, Kate Rogers, and Phil LeBeau. Great to have you on set, Phil. Good to see you. All right. So let's start with this. Trouble in Tesla land today. Some maybe bad news out of California and Morgan Stanley trying to drag down the stock. New Tesla registrations in California fell nearly 50% in the fourth quarter. That's according to a report from Dominion Cross Sell. The massive drop due to the rollout or rollback in the EV tax credit, given California's status as a bellwether market, this could be a troubling sign for the company. To top it all off, Morgan Stanley's analyst Adam Jonas downgrading the stock, questioning the sustainability of the momentum, and yet raising his price target to $360. Phil LeBeau, obviously you're here. I'm going to start with you on this. Do we know why the registrations may have dropped off that much?
I think that that's a conclusion that's wrong in terms of it's just the incentive falling off. Look, when they started making the Model 3, and that's really what you need to look at more than the S and the X, they first filled orders in California. As they have expanded around the world, and remember, they're supplying the world, with the exception of the beginning of China right now, they're supplying the world from Fremont. And as they are supplying other areas, they're going to be selling fewer in California.
So you think it's a measure of where the registrations are.
Correct.
That they shouldn't have just looked at California, should have looked maybe globally or at least across the United
States. And that's why we go with the delivery numbers, which is a global number where, and we have the graphic right now, but it basically shows that they hit their target of 360,000. Occasionally you will see these stories like sales have fallen off in the United States of Tesla. Well, that's because they're supplying Europe or they're supplying other countries around the world. And as they have expanded where they are supplying the vehicles, certain markets close to home, California, are not going to see as many deliveries in a particular quarter or half a year.
Yeah, and Robert, listen, the downgrade from Jonas and Morgan Stanley, I understand it's a downgrade, okay?
Yeah.
But if you look into it, he's really still bullish on the core auto side of the story.
Yeah.
It's more about the mobility and the price of the stock.
Look, they've added $40 billion or more in market cap just over the past month, and yet, aside from China, which was a huge announcement but expected, there hasn't been anything brand new surprising about Tesla to add that $40 billion. But my question to you, Phil, is with these tax credits going away, that is a meaningful dollar amount.
Yes,
it
is.
So what percentage do you think off sales will that, especially because a lot of people went into it to rush to buy before they spill up. So you will get that lapping effect that will see a decrease. But over time, how meaningful do you think that is?
I think that they're to the point now where they are the brand when you talk about electric vehicles.
So it won't really matter.
I have yet to run into somebody saying, I'm thinking about buying an electric vehicle. You know, I was thinking about the Bolt. I was thinking about the Leaf. When I hear people say this to me, they say, I'm thinking about an electric vehicle. I'm thinking about a Tesla.
Yeah.
That is it. I see nothing else. I see no other.
I did see an e-tron on the road, the Audi, on the other day. And by the way, they're not getting great reviews.
No.
So it might be pushing people back to
Tesla. Tesla has become to electric vehicles what Kleenex is in tissue.
It's the verb. It's the Google. Yeah, I'm going to Google it. I'm going to Xerox it. Okay, so Tesla's the new Kleenex. That's the bottom line on this one. All right, let's talk about...
George Shires are crying.
There you go. Shiny gold stuff. Signet. The jewelry retailer reporting holiday sales growth of 1.5%. Doesn't sound like a lot, but it was better than most analysts' expectations. They also raised their fourth quarter guidance. Shares of Signet once pretty much left for dead not too long ago, speaking of short sellers, but today they're soaring, not a misprint, 43%. Some of that arguably is short covering, but let's bring in now Courtney Reagan to talk about this maybe diamond in the rough. Courtney, online sales up 13.5%, proving people don't just buy commodity items. They're buying expensive or relatively expensive jewelry online.
It is interesting. I think when Blue Nile first started, I thought, who's going to buy diamonds online? But guess what? People do. Yeah, they had some pretty strong e-commerce numbers, up 13.5%. This was the first strong holiday season that Signet had basically since 2015. And it was really a shock to see same-store sales up 1.6% when the analysts were thinking that they would be down 2 to 4%. I mean, that's a pretty big bump up. We talk about Signet, but just so everyone knows, of course, those are the mall jewelry stores, the
Jared, they own pretty
the
much
sales,
everything, right?
The K, the Piercing Pagoda, exactly. And so you have some divergent trends within some of those. But Zales, for example, so same-store sales up 5.4%. And Jefferies had thought those would just be flat. So that's a really big kind of blow-it-out-of-the-water number.
What do you think they're getting right about e-commerce? Because that was my takeaway. Yeah. The e-commerce number is so big, up over 13%. But they are the mall jewelry store at a more discounted price, too, might I add. So what do you think they're kind of doing right that's getting consumers to make the move online?
So they've a couple things. They've had more targeted marketing, which, look, it sounds sort of like how can that be the answer? But to cut through the noise, you have to have really good marketing to get people to go to your site because of all the choices that we have. They also had some product newness. They called out specific campaigns that actually did pretty well that were new. And the quarter before, they had a lot of promotions running that they needed to really remove the needle and get people to buy. They didn't have to do it this time, and the company thinks it was because of the marketing and the product newness. But 3,000 stores, and many of them are in the mall, so I thought that was interesting.
But I do wonder, you and I talked about this earlier today in the hallway, which is all the best conversations are in the hallway.
That's true.
Which is, do you wonder if the stock market's record high, Kate, is having some kind of a positive wealth effect on things like a Signet, like, you know, your 401k is up, your savings are up, so you think, you know what, I've been looking at this necklace.
Why not?
Heck, I'm going to treat myself or I'm going to treat my family member because I feel a little richer.
I mean, that could definitely be a part of it. And the holiday retail sales, I mean, up over 4%.
What's also surprising to me, though, is what we heard about jewelry covering Bulgari and Tiffany is that the whole jewelry sector is struggling because younger people, millennials especially, are casual. They don't like jewelry. And yet they're overcoming that. Right. Not only with jewelry, but with the mall.
The other thing I'm wondering, trend-wise, is jewelry a more durable retail purchase than an extra sweater or clothing? Sure. Does it feel
pass
less...
Pass it down. Gold is gold. As long as you don't lose it, don't lose it like an AirPod.
But, you know, does it feel less wasteful as we talk about sort of re-commerce and reselling?
You're buying an asset.
More about buying, too. To your point about people potentially feeling better and waiting to make these bigger purchases.
Yeah, pass it down. Guys, thank you. Courtney, great discussion.
Hey, thanks for having me after that hallway talk.
Yep, she went to Jared. Tune in to Closing Bell by the time today. That's her husband's name. Come at 3 p.m. today. The CEO of Signet will be on to talk about some of those stellar holiday sales numbers, the company's guidance going forward, and how many people are willing to buy, you know, necklaces and jewelry online. Apparently a lot. All right, topic number three, from Grubhub to Uber Eats. The way that you get your food delivered certainly has changed dramatically over the years, but one thing that has not changed is what you're ordering online. According to NPD Group, pizza, still the most ordered item in the United States. Historically, Domino's has been the leader, but if you look at stock performance, Papa John's actually starting to rally a bit here. Kate, this is right in your pizza wheelhouse, if you will. You know why? Because pizza comes hot and fresh.
As long as it does come, as long as it's hot.
So the Papa John's move, obviously, there's a lot of excitement around Rob Lynch, who the company brought in after this John Schnatter and then Steve Ritchie
debacle.
Ordeal, and he came over from Arby's. I think there's a lot of investor excitement about him. But Domino's still has about 18% of the total quick service pizza market share. That's according to QSR. They're a trade publication. Regional chains, 52%. The other chains in the space, the Pizza Hut, the Little Caesars, the Blaze Pizzas, what have you, those are about 30%. So Domino's is still the leader. And as we always talk about, they're not working with any aggregators. They're doing it all in-house. And part
Maybe
of their
that's
strategy.
Why it's
winning.
Well, you could argue either way.
They have quality control over the delivery with those bags.
That is what the CEO
shield and.
I mean, that is, you know, his entire goal in keeping this in house is the quality control from start to finish. It's our product, and don't forget, they're doing this fortressing operation, so they're opening up more stores closer together, so you have a Domino's closer to you in your neighborhood, so that delivery time is even shorter. The pizza's even hotter when it gets to you, and it's working. So say what you know about the stock.
I would add that whether it's Uber Eats, Grubhub, whoever it might be, there's no consistency there. Sometimes I've had meals delivered. Great. Other times you get like a burger and fries.
It's an hour and a half
are
late.
Terrible.
They're half gone.
Well, in my neighborhood, some are half gone.
The restaurant doesn't care, and that's the issue.
Doesn't care.
But it's the quality control of the pizza coming in. And by the way, Domino's, the genius move they've made from a business perspective, I think, is when you order on your phone or the computer, you can see where it is.
Oh, yeah.
You're like, oh, it just came out of the oven. Oh, they're on the road. And so my kids sort of watch it, like, when is it going to get here? You know? All right. The rich are renting at higher rates, and developers are trying to keep up with that demand. According to real estate analytics firm RealPage, builders are on track to finish more new apartments this year than in any year in three decades, adding a total of 371,000 units to the market. Of those apartments, nearly 80%, Robert, are luxury rentals, a sign that the rich are nervous or just don't want to pay some of these incredible numbers that are going around cities like New York and
San Francisco. It's a sign of two things. One is just to build over the past 5 years in any city cost you so much money that on a per square foot basis, you have to make it a luxury unit to make money, whether it's $2,000 a square foot or here in New York, $6,000 a square foot just to break even on a development. So it has to be luxury. Secondly, there's so much inventory out there for the rich that they don't want to buy right now. They think prices are going to fall. There's so much choice. So the wealthy are camping out in these rentals until the buying prices fall. So there's just a huge amount of supply.
I think the word luxury is so overused.
Top 10.
I mean, let's be clear. There's apartments that are literally, you could reach out and touch a highway, the Lincoln Tunnel thing going in. It's like luxury homes. I'm like, there's a car.
But it's got an Onyx bathroom, so it's luxury.
4 feet. Is there any sort of qualification standard for calling something luxury?
Yes. The traditional definition is top 10% of the market by price. That's what I do.
Or an Onyx bathroom.
I thought it was so interesting in reading this that on average it's about $500 a month higher than other apartments in New York. And then in L.A. it's about $800 a month higher. But what's your take on this whole idea that it may encourage some people who are at the higher end of middle class to move up to a luxury building and create more affordable housing?
Sure, if they could afford it. But I think it's not a good message for the real problem in this country, which is a lack of affordable housing inventory.
Let's talk Chicago, man, because I tell you, awesome city, by the way. And you look at the south side of the city, and there's these giant, amazing, every time I go back to Chicago, there's like six new buildings. Are they full?
I can knock door to door next time, and I'll find out for you. I think that
Grubhub.
Here you go. Here's your inconsistent
Tesla and your Tesla delivering pizzas.
I think they're full. I mean, I do not see reports of them being empty.
Yeah, we never talk about Chicago. I try to throw the great Chicago.
I will say there's a lot of Airbnb rentals now in my building, which I don't consider to be a super high end. It's a nicer apartment.
You live in New Jersey.
Yes.
Because it's borderline illegal in New York. I think you have to live in the building that you rent.
I think people are still doing it.
They still do it.
Yeah.
Finally.
I have no neighbors.
Nike's Vaporfly was the shoe, or is the shoe, that may be too good to be true. The sneakers carried various athletes to 19 top finishes, 6 world marathon wins across the world, and now World Athletics is planning to ban that shoe, apparently, for giving runners what they view as an unfair advantage. And there's actually some stuff here, Phil LeBeau. If you look at it, apparently
it are we supposed to look at these notes before we come
Yes,
up?
You no, are. No. Nike Sport Research Lab says supposed to redistribute the offset from 11 millimeters to 8 millimeters to provide a more stable feeling and help maximize the energy return at the critical toe off.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually have science that the shoe makes you good.
Yes. Hey, I'm bummed that they're going to get rid of these. I enjoy seeing this new technology that you can make an argument that is artificially helping out runners or sprinters, whoever it is. It's just like when they had the ultra-fast swimsuits, and they ultimately banned those. I love seeing it.
It's a fine line between technological innovation and mechanical doping. And the question is, because these shoes cost over $250, are you giving a mechanical advantage to those who can afford those shoes? And therefore,
that's what I was going to say. Why doesn't all these athletes just buy the shoes?
Because they're very expensive.
Well, if you're a top athlete, though, you're not buying.
No, but amateur runners are getting, when they looked at the data, 4% better times.
4% from that shoe.
But,
which is an amazing amount of time when you're talking about marathons or any of these things.
They did mention, though, the psychological effects of believing that the shoe makes you faster as well. So how much does that play into, if you're running just a little bit?
Let's show the shoe again. It doesn't look like much. Apparently, it's the material the sole.
Brian, you know that what amputee runners wear? They're the blades that get them so bad. That's what this is. This is a mini carbon fiber blade inside the sneaker that gives you that spring that allows you to run fast.
Kind of the swoosh looks like the front of the Dreamliner paint job, Philibo.
I like it.
All right, good stuff. Rapid fire over for today. Phil, great to have you on set. Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you.
All right, piecing together bits of information to form a Frankenstein-like identity sounds like something out of a horror story, but it's actually very real. For some smaller financial institutions, it's very painful. Kate Rooney up to talk about Frankenstein fraud coming up. Well, apparently many criminals are taking a page out of Mary Shelley's playbook and piercing together identities a la Dr. Frankenstein to defraud financial institutions. Kate Rooney joining us now with more on this horror story. Kate.
Hey, Brian. So its official name is synthetic identity fraud. This is the fastest growing and one of the hardest financial crimes to detect. So instead of stealing an identity, a criminal makes one of these Frankenstein IDs up. They randomly pick, or they can buy a social security number. Then they link other fake information, like an address, for example. They slowly build credit over multiple years. Finally, they open accounts with financial institutions, take out loans with no plans to pay those back. I spoke to one federal credit union in Indiana that was caught off guard by synthetic fraud. They ended up with $200,000 worth of losses, which, of course, is a major hit for a small lender. Some in Silicon Valley are taking on the issue. I spoke to one founder of startup Centrelink. He says these fake people can show certain erratic patterns.
They'll be moving around quite a lot. They'll be aggressively growing credit. And in many cases, we even see fraud rings that have produced a number of different synthetic identities, so like 100 of them, all of whom behave in the same unusual ways. And so we can use data to differentiate the identities that are actually real, most just regular people like us, from the synthetic identities that have been fictitiously created.
Centrelink estimates this is hitting lenders to the tune of $2 to $3 billion per year. And as for how somebody could get away with using a real social security number, I'm told it does raise some red flags with credit bureaus, but they're often seen by banks as human error since the rest of the person's profile doesn't match. Lenders often write it off as a credit loss. Brian.
So, Kate, as everything moves online, everything's trying to get easier and faster and more mobile, are we seeing more sort of synthetic fraud because it's just numbers behind a computer or a phone screen?
Exactly. So that's great in some ways that this process is getting easier and faster. But experts I spoke to say that that's also adding to the possibility for people to take advantage. You also have this economic boom we've seen and lenders loosening credit. So it's been easier for people to get loans, which, again, could be a good thing. But they're doing it faster. And experts say that's one other theme that's adding to this. The last part of this, of course, is data breaches. Mm-hmm. So it's easier to buy information on the dark web. One of the tactics that they use is buying the social security numbers of younger people. So minors, if you have the social security number of somebody who's under the age of 18, they definitely won't notice until they go and apply for credit.
Wow.
That's another theme we're seeing.
Taking kids' social security numbers. It's unbelievable. Kate Rooney, important story. Thanks for bringing it to us, Kate. We'll see you soon.
Thanks,
Brian. All right, the housing market may be heating up overall. Homebuyer demand's at 11-year high, but remodeling appears to be cooling off. Why and what it means for the real estate market and maybe the likes of Lowe's and Home Depot. As we go out to the break, let's take a look at the markets right now. We are near session highs. The Dow up 184, 0.6% gain, more new records. The markets and their juggernaut, seemingly unstoppable rally, will continue right after this. All right, welcome back. There's something rather unusual happening in the housing market right now. It's heating up right in the dead of winter on the East Coast. Strong demand pushing sales. However, one corner of the market is showing some cracks, signs of weakness. Diana Ulick joining us now with more on the remodeling side of the story. Diana.
That's right, Brian. Home remodeling is actually pulling back now. People usually remodel sometime in the year after they close on a home. So sales last year were lower annually for most of the year, and that's the problem. That means home remodeling, which historically grows around 5% a year, will barely grow at all this year, just about 1.5%, according to a new report from Harvard's Joint Center for Housing. In 2018, just as a comparison, remodeling growth hit 7%. Now, spending will start the year at an annual rate of about $326 billion and not go much higher than $333 billion by the end of the year. That, of course, could hit the stocks of the big remodeling retailers like Home Depot, Lowe's, and Masco. They all saw big growth last fall when mortgage rates were coming down and sales started to pick up. If sales are more robust this year, that'll push remodeling spending higher. But right now, a severe shortage of homes for sale is standing in the way. One bright note, though, the shortage continues to keep some potential buyers in place. And the longer you stay in the house, the more you tend to fix things that are broken. Brian?
All right, Diana. Look, Diana, thank you very much. All right. Despite the forecast of the slowdown in renovations, like Diana just talked about, your next guest still favors some of the building product stocks over the home builders themselves. Here now to explain is Ken Zener. He is equity research analyst at KeyBank Capital Markets. So, Ken, you heard Diana's report. Does that bode ill for all the home remodeling companies?
Thank you, Brian. We agree with Harvard Joint Center's idea that remodeling is inflecting to a positive rate versus their prior estimates. I disagree with their baseline. I think it's a little too conservative. We do think the main factor driving remodeling spend is home prices. And in fact, we're starting to see home prices inflect if you look at some indices like CoreLogic.
Okay. And you like a company like a Masco, MAS, you call it the R&R. I guess that means repair and remodel, I'm guessing, because it's all about the stuffs like the paint and the plumbing.
Right. So what we have, you know, remodeling, yes, historically it had high correlations to housing turnover that Diane referred to. But we see better correlations when we look at home price appreciation, which is improving. That's really important because what we have is an older, wealthier ownership base following the housing crisis. And they're an older home. So what we're seeing is remodeling. We do like lower ticket items such as paint and plumbing for some higher ticket remodeling type items.
Okay, you like also a company called Top Build, BLD. I don't even care what they do because I'm looking at the stock chart, Ken. It's off the charts. 130% gain for BLD in 12 months, and you still like it.
We do. This is a bit of a hybrid. So they are the largest installer of insulation in new construction. So residential is about 80% of their end market. So we do think housing is growing. As an installer of insulation, they kind of have a trifecta of operating leverage in the sense that they should get price on labor. There is a little bit of price increase in insulation of the product, and they get operating leverage. So we think that bodes well for them. The other 20% of their business is commercial construction.
Thank you. Ken Zener, KeyBank Capital Markets, like MAS and BLD, and you're A-OK. We appreciate it, Ken. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
We're just a few hours away from unveiling the new NBC Universal streaming service, Peacock. It's a big deal for our company. It's a big deal for you. And we'll give you the key announcements you can expect coming up. All right, well, it's a big day for us here in the NBC Universal family because our parent company, NBC Universal, unveiling the details of its new streaming service, Peacock, today at 4 p.m. Julia Boorstin joining us now with a preview of what we can expect. What's it going to look like, Julia?
Well, Brian, NBC Universal's Peacock is taking a different approach than Netflix, Disney Plus, or Apple TV Plus because it will include ads. Today, we'll learn key details about the service, which is launching in April. We expect there to be a free ad-supported tier. We'll see how much content is included. We're also looking for pricing and how much content will be included in two other tiers. One's expected to be in the $5 range with ads, and another reportedly will be in the $10 a month range with more content and no ads. Now, that will be included free for Comcast cable subscribers, giving them more reason to keep paying for the TV bundle. We'll see how much live programming NBC Universal includes. That would be another differentiator from the other subscription streamers. And while Peacock has announced a range of originals, most of its 15,000 hours of content will be a deep library, including The Office. We'll have to see what kind of guidance the company gives on subscribers and also costs. Brian?
It's a big day, and we'll let you get back to it. We'll look forward to the unveiling of Peacock today at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. We haven't seen it either. So, Julia, thank you very much. Appreciate that. All right, got a few seconds left here. Let's talk about these markets. I know Tyler and the gang of Power Lunch are going to pick it up, but more new
highs. The Dow just off its high of the session, up about 180 points. And Morgan Stanley, the big gainer in the S&P, up 7.5%. You got Charles Schwab and WDC Western Digital also doing well.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.